The second case, will the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call Fort Worth Independent School District, Joseph Colangola. And may it please the court, Mr. Thomas Brent, arguing for the appellant, and Mr. Paul Wineski, arguing for the appellant.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Tom Brandt for Fort Worth ISD. This case arises out of a statutory buyout. This is an appeal of the denial of a plea to the jurisdiction brought by Fort Worth ISD against a former employer who's brought a whistleblower claim against it. As I said, this case rises out of a statutory buyout of Mr. Balazzolo on February 14th of 2012. That buyout was pursuant to the Texas Education Code, section 21.304F. It was provided and mentioned to Fort Worth ISD at the end of, by the Texas Commissioner of Education, when he ruled on a particular hearing that occurred under Chapter 21, a lengthy administrative hearing. At the end of that hearing, the Texas Commissioner of Education said, you have an option, Fort Worth. You can redo the Chapter 21 hearing. This is 2 years after it had gone through that process. Or you can buy him out, which means you pay him all of his past wages and you pay him 1 year front wages. That is the February 14th, 2012 action that was taken unanimously by the Fort Worth Board of Trustees. The issue before the court is whether the trial court had jurisdiction over the case. And the problem that occurred was that after that February 14th, 2012 decision, an internal grievance process began. It was initiated by Mr. Palazzolo, was participated in by Fort Worth ISD. Both parties misunderstood the law at that time. Both parties thought that that was the appropriate process. Then later, we learned through a series of decisions, El Paso Court of Appeals in two decisions, we have the Eastland Court of Appeals, and then we have a federal district court and a federal appellate court decision. Kell, Boswell, Whitney, and then the two Powers decisions. They come out. We become, after this court ruled on Palazzolo 2, this court has already ruled on Palazzolo 1. There's been four cases, many administrative appeals. It's been going on for nearly a decade. But after this court ruled on Palazzolo 2 and said that that trial needs to be redone because Fort Worth ISD was entitled to an affirmative defense, you didn't give them to him, so you have to retry the case. After that point, my partner and I realized through the Kell decision what the scales fell off our eyes, and we realized, my goodness, this is a jurisdictional issue. And it can't, and it's, as Mr. Palazzolo's lawyers explain in their brief, and we agree, the governmental immunity cannot be waived except through statute. So you look at the statute. There can't be waived through participation in an internal grievance. There's no equitable estoppel, waiver by conduct. All of those of waiver issues that you've heard about have been specifically dealt with and rejected in the law, in the Texas courts. But what would be appropriate is if there were some sort of tolling provision that existed in the statute. It doesn't. What it says is 30 days. And what happened is at the end of that lengthy two-year administrative process, when the option is given to Fort Worth ISD, it exercises its option, and then that particular option that Mr. Palazzolo exercised was to exhaust. He didn't have to exhaust, but he did. He had to initiate. That was the first jurisdictional thing he had to do, and he absolutely did that. He initiated his grievance under Chapter 21. That was the first jurisdictional issue. Then he had a choice. He could proceed through that Chapter 21 process for 61 days, and that at that point, he could have jettisoned and said, see ya, I'm going to district court. He didn't do that, which was his right. He went all the way through the hearing to the end, and it was concluded. And there's no dispute from Mr. Palazzolo that at the end of that process, on February 14th, those administrative processes were exhausted. When the option was given to the Fort Worth ISD to pay out and pay the front pay to Mr. Palazzolo. So that was what happened. Then you look and say, okay, Mr. Palazzolo didn't take the 61-day track, he took the exhaustion track. So at the end of that exhaustion, the language of the statute couldn't be clearer. Now, despite the fact that I couldn't see it and his lawyer couldn't see it, it was in the law and it was revealed to us by the courts of appeals in their various decisions. There is not one decision, reported decision out there that we can find that says anything other than the position that we're taking now, which is that the exhaustion requirement triggers a 30-day statute of limitations, period. There's no other case out there. And you'll notice in the briefing, we've mentioned all five cases, we've talked about them, and you'll notice that Mr. Palazzolo's counsel doesn't talk about Powers at all, except to, I guess, dismissive in the fact that, well, that's a federal court, not binding. But it certainly is authoritative, and it shows, that particular case shows there was exhaustion. What you have in the Kell and the Powers and the Whitney cases are talking about the initiation and saying you have to initiate through Chapter 21. When we get to Powers, it's clear they initiated, and the courts of the district court there, the federal district court, and the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans both said you initiated and you exhausted and you filed within 30 days, therefore you're okay. That was in the Powers decision, so it addressed this issue. Now, what you have here is a very clear presentation now that we've all understood what this line of cases holds. Though that wasn't clear at the time, but there was never any effort on anyone's part to mislead. And besides the fact, that was a simple mutual mistake that both people made, both parties made, and the fact of the matter is, the law, whether we saw it or not, whether we recognized it or not, it cannot be that that action of participating or allowing this procedure to go through somehow waived governmental immunity, because the governmental immunity, as you know, through the Chadha decision, a statute of limitations defense, which is what this is a jurisdictional issue, because it is part of, that's why it can be brought in a plea of jurisdiction. So those are the sole issue we have here. And you'll have a lot of, I think, distraction, but that is the clear path through the forest of this litigation, which has been going on for, like I said, nearly 10 years.
Is there a distinction when Mr. Palazzolo initiated the Chapter 21 grievance process?
Yes.
That was for a proposed termination, and he was asserting, he asserted whistleblower status in order to avoid a pending termination and to demonstrate that a termination as it had been proposed by the board was a wrongful, and therefore he could avoid that termination. Okay. What I need you to address is what effect does the remedy that the board asserted, that the school district asserted under 21.304F, have in terms of, does it vitiate the whistleblower defense, if you will, and therefore when that's invoked, and as you say, that creates an exhaustion of the process with regard to the proposed termination and allows the school district to go forward with the termination, is it irrespective of the whistleblower assertion with regard to avoidance? Can you basically just negate the whistleblower avoidance when you adopt that remedy or assert that remedy or invoke that remedy?
And Judge Birdwell, that's a very good question. I've spent a lot of time thinking about that issue, and I think here's the answer. You have a red herring when you hear the Palazzolo talk about a proposed and actual termination. That's not truly what's going on here. That would happen in many cases. You'd have a proposed and an actual termination.
Well, let's use different language. One is he's trying to avoid the termination.
Right.
And the other is on the basis of whistleblower. But based upon this particular provision, you can say we can go forward with the termination.
Well,
if we pay X amount, and then the termination can occur, and then he's in a, I've been damaged because I've been wrongfully terminated as a whistleblower, which is not an avoidance of the termination. It is now more of a damages type of assertion.
Right. I understand what you're saying, and this is what I think the answer is.
In other words, there's a remedy.
There is a remedy under whistleblower.
Whistleblower is a defense, not a remedy with regard to what he initiated under Chapter 21. Once that is wiped out by what you did in invoking the statutory remedy, he's left with an actual statutory remedy for damages that he couldn't assert before the termination, but he can now.
Well, let me go over the timeline to answer the question. Back up a minute, because what we have is October 26th is the proposed termination, okay? That action does create something. That action by the board was something that could be grieved as a whistleblower action, and he did. That's what the Chapter 21 process was. It was an exhaustion that he had to initiate, right? And at the end of that process, then what normally happens is the end of the process would be you either had a good reason to fire this man or you didn't. But it wouldn't address the whistleblower claim itself. The whistleblower claim would then, you could assert that in district court. Now, he could have done this, which he didn't do. He could have gone through and asserted the whistleblower claim based on the October 26th action, October 26, 2010. Then Fort Worth ISD could have said, all right, we litigate that now, but we get credit for all the payments that we made for you, and so your damages are whatever happened. You're no longer employed, but so you've got damages if you can prove that, number one, we retaliated against you, and number two, that you would have still been employed. So there is the invocation of the statutory option doesn't cut off the whistleblower claim. What it does is it invokes the exhaustion and invokes the 30-day statute of limitations. So if he had met the 30-day statute of limitations, then I couldn't be standing here and saying, well, you don't have a whistleblower claim because we brought you out. No, that's not right. But I could say we get a credit for that amount. Now, there's a case, Garcia, I wanted to tell you about. The Garcia versus Corpus Christi ISD, 866 Fed Sup, 2nd, 646, Southern District, Texas, 2011. That case talked about the statutory option and saying the statutory option cannot give rise to a whistleblower claim. It's an option that the state of Texas gives and the commissioner referred to. So we had that option. It was a completely legal option to take. But what he did wrong was he then filed a lawsuit claiming that the February 14th, 2012 action was a grievable action under the whistleblower case. Under Whistleblower Act. No, it was the proposed termination that started this. If that proposed termination was truly retaliatory under the Whistleblower Act, then he could have, within 30 days of February 14th, he could have filed that lawsuit and referred back to the October 26, 2010 action and said, that started me on this path. And although I've been made whole up to this point because you paid me on my back way, paid me front pay, I still think I should have been here longer. I would have stayed here my whole career. I would have retired. I could have. He can make those claims. I hope I've made myself clear on that. We're not saying that the statutory option is a nuke that's dropped on his whistleblower claim. No, it is what it is a precise option that allows
the school district to actually effectuate the actual termination.
Effectively, it is, but it.
Okay, so
it,
that's
it
the actual. That's the event that effectuates the termination. The decision to terminate was made in October of 2010.
Yes, but it's not that action on February 14th is not an action that can be brought under the Whistleblower Act, is what I'm saying. It cannot form the basis of a whistleblower claim. Only the proposed termination can, which was way back when. And I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Excuse me, may it please the court. Paul Wineski here for the plaintiff, Joseph Palazzolo. In order for this court to accept the arguments of the school district, this court would have to ignore, as the school district stubbornly ignores, half of the policies of the school district itself that were involved in this case as it worked its way through the grievance and appeal process. This is the third time that the district has brought these arguments before this court. The first time was in a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction filed 45 days after this court issued its original opinion. The opinion issued in July of 2016. This court denied that motion. The district re-urged those arguments in a motion for rehearing, which this court also denied. The district then took the arguments to the Texas Supreme Court, which requested full briefing on the merits, giving them the opportunity to make all of these arguments to the Texas Supreme Court and argue for the sweeping changes in the law that they argue for. And the Texas Supreme Court denied that petition for review. The arguments were then made again in the trial court as a plea to the jurisdiction. That was correctly denied. And here we are again, 2.5 years after this court's original opinion in this case, which remanded the case back for a new trial. This is particularly vexing, I would think, for anyone who lives in the Fort Worth Independent School District, because it's taxpayer funds that are funding this never-ceasing appellate litigation. But the bottom line in this case is simply this. The Fort Worth Independent School District wrote the rules. They wrote their policies. Joseph Palazzolo followed those rules to the letter. And now the district says, oh, well, wait a minute. Because you followed our rules to the letter, you have now lost forever your ability to pursue a Whistleblower Act violation claim.
And that sounds very unfair, but can the rules and regs for the ISD trump the statute?
I don't think the rules and regulations do trump the statute. I believe that the school district is misinterpreting the statute. The school district is conflating the provisions of Chapter 21 of the Education Code with the Whistleblower Act, and they are conflating the policies of the school district governing Chapter 21 appeals with the policies governing whistleblower actions.
And the cases they cite don't support their position, is that what you're saying?
I do not believe that they do, and here's why. In each of those cases, the plaintiff failed to do what no one disputes that Joseph Palazzolo did in this case. In each of those cases, the plaintiff failed to initiate and follow through with the Chapter 21 pre-termination grievance process or appeal process. But as Judge Birdwell has correctly divined, those are two separate things. Any teacher, whether they think they have a whistleblower claim or not, any teacher who wishes to appeal a proposed contract termination has to use the Chapter 21 appeals process, and it's all a pre-termination process. Nobody disputes that Joseph Palazzolo did that, and nobody disputes that none of the plaintiffs in the Kell, Whitney, or Boswell cases attempted that.
Well, let's say that Fort Worth ISD rules and regulations are against the statute and they shouldn't have been adopted and
I realize that your client followed them, but since the 30-day provision for limitations is jurisdictional, how do we get around that? I mean, as Justice Sutter commented, it doesn't sound fair, but jurisdiction is jurisdiction, isn't it?
The way you get around that is to, again, read the words of the statute of both the Whistleblower Act and the school district's policies under the plain meaning of the words. Both the Whistleblower Act and the policies of the school district speak in terms of an adverse employment decision that has occurred. Not that you've gotten notice that we propose to do this, but that has actually occurred. And those are two different things. And if the court takes nothing away from this argument but this, I would like for the court to study a single page of a single policy of the Fort Worth Independent School District. It's policy DG. It is included as appendix in our appendix at tab F. And it is the policy that specifically addresses whistleblower complaints. And on page 2 of that policy, which is at page 353 of the clerk's record, and again, also in our appendix, here's the language. It mirrors the whistleblower statute. Before suing, an employee must initiate action under the district's grievance policy or other applicable policies. Maybe a little ambiguity there, but next paragraph. The employee must invoke the district's grievance procedure not later than the 90th day after the adverse employment decision. Next paragraph. If the board does not render a final decision before the 61st day, the employee may elect to, number one, exhaust the district's grievance procedure and then sue. Or, number two, terminate district grievance procedures. And then the parenthetical after that, see DGBA regarding grievance procedures. I realize I'm getting into the policy weeds. I think the court was correct to originally elect to have this submitted only on briefs because it lends itself to that kind of analysis. But the applicable grievance procedures are the ones that the school district has labeled whistleblower complaints. And those do not kick in until after the termination has been finalized, because that's the language of the policy, and that is the language of the Whistleblower Act itself. It refers to an action that has occurred, not that has been proposed to occur. None of those cases cited by the appellants declare that the Chapter 21 process is the exclusive and only method to initiate grievance procedures under the Act. Again, to say you initiate the grievance procedure by grieving your proposed termination and then the statute of limitations starts to run at the February 14th, 2012 vote simply ignores the language of both the Whistleblower Act and the school district's policies. None of the cases declare that this is the exclusive method. None of the cases declare this is the only one that can be used. And, by the way, the school district took the diametrically opposite position in the trial court when it argued in the hearing on attorney's fees that, oh, no, the TEA process is not the jurisdictional prerequisite for a Whistleblower Act case. It's the internal grievance policies of the school district.
But a party cannot create subject matter jurisdiction by estoppel, can it?
I do not believe it can, Your Honor. But again, I believe that the district's argument is based on a flawed reading of the Whistleblower Act and Chapter 21 and the policies of the school district that have been enacted thereunder, because they lay out a very clear path. And for that matter, I think it would be the height of injustice for Mr. Palazzolo to follow the rules to the letter, and the school district follow the same rules, they have their own hearing examiner in writing up their level 2 grievance decision to say, these are the policies that apply, the ones that I'm talking to the court about, the ones that govern whistleblower actions and the ones that govern the employee grievance that Mr. Palazzolo filed soon after that termination vote. Again, they took the diametrically opposite position in the trial court about what the proper jurisdictional prerequisite was. They took the diametrically opposite position in Palazzolo 1, as they call it, which was the first time this Court of Appeals dealt with a Palazzolo claim. And the district said it's the internal grievance procedures that are the jurisdictional prerequisite, and this court agreed. Yes, they are. And he did not meet them. Therefore, the summary judgment granted to the district in that case was properly granted.
What was the effect of their choice of the buyout, the statutory buyout?
I don't see any material effect to that at all. They still terminated his contract.
I mean, what's the language of that provision with regard to what manner is it a remedy that's available to the school district? What is it remedying? In other words, is it allowing them to effectuate the termination, as I suggested earlier, and therefore it allows the TEA to terminate, was it the TEA, TEC, whatever, to dismiss the grievance procedure under Chapter 21 if they agree and invoke that, and therefore the entire grievance procedure clearly terminates at that point in time?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, it allows them to not go back through a complete Chapter 21 appeal procedure, just to go ahead and terminate the contract, which is the adverse action that Mr. Palazzolo complains of under the whistleblower statute. The fact that he got 1 year's front pay and benefits doesn't negate the fact that his contract was terminated and he was not able to continue in that position for years and years until he could retire.
So even though the whistleblower statute creates a judicial remedy, okay, what I hear you saying and what I think they're arguing is that it ineffectively terminating the grievance proceeding, okay, that they're basically arguing that you should have at that point in time gone ahead with the judicial remedy.
That is their
but
argument.
Your interpretation is that no, that effectively just terminates the entire thing, and we had to restart the grievance process under what their policy was.
Yes, Your Honor, because again, the Chapter 21 appeal process applies to proposed terminations. They can dismiss that word all they want to. It appears 44 times in their brief. The Whistleblower Act and their policies they're under specifically talk about a termination that has occurred. That's a finalized termination, not a notice of termination, but the vote on February the 14th of 2012. That is when the termination occurred, and that, under their policies, is when the 90 days started running for him to initiate the grievance procedures of the district, the district's grievance procedures, not the Chapter 21 pre-termination appeal procedure, but the district's grievance procedures. The language is clear. And it also is identical to the language in the Whistleblower Act, which, again, talks about the employer's grievance procedures and gives the employee a 90-day deadline after this adverse employment action has occurred, not been proposed, but occurred, to go ahead and initiate those procedures and then proceed through. The district has not cited a single case in which a whistleblower plaintiff has filed a Chapter 21 appeal with the Texas Education Agency and then, after the 61st day has passed, dismissed that appeal and filed a lawsuit. It's just they're attempting to conflate two statutes that don't go together. The district's policies go together quite well. They're mutually exclusive. The whistleblower grievance procedure says this does not apply to a proposed contract termination or other contract action. That's the Chapter 21 procedure. The Chapter 21 procedure doesn't apply to whistleblower complaints. They're mutually exclusive. They're meant to work in an integrated fashion. I'm not going to argue that it's the most efficient process in the world, but that's the school district wrote the rules. They can rewrite the rules. I would wonder whether they've already rewritten their rules to remove what they are now admitting would be a trap for the unwary. I haven't looked.
What would have happened had there not been an invocation of this buyout provision and there was a determination on the merits in favor of your client that prevented termination?
Then you would not have an adverse employment action and there would not have been a whistleblower claim. But in other words,
So the whistleblower claim is, in fact, a defense and avoidance.
I don't know if I would go that far, Your Honor. What I would say is if the board had not taken the ultimate adverse employment action, which is not the proposed termination, it's the vote on February the 14th, had that not happened, had they said, we will reinstate you and you can be an assistant principal again, then he wouldn't have had a whistleblower claim, I don't think, because there would not have been an adverse employment action. A finalized one, not a proposed one, a finalized one. I believe I've talked enough, unless there are any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You heard Mr. Wineski talk about the school district wrote the rules, but the rules we're talking about that are operative here, the school district didn't write. And as Judge Sutter and Judge Curry, you mentioned, it's the legislature who handles the Whistleblower Act. They're the ones who passed the Whistleblower Act. They are also the ones who established the education code provisions under Chapter 21. Whatever the school district does or doesn't do can have no effect on changing the language that the legislature wrote. And Judge Birdwell, you had asked about the language of 21304F. It starts with E, where it says, if the commissioner reverses the action of the Board of Trustees, the commissioner shall order the school district to reinstate the teacher and pay the teacher any back pay and employment benefits from the time of discharge or suspension to reinstatement. So you have, that's the back pay, and you have to reinstatement. Then it says F.
So there is, in fact, a termination.
That would be, it's effectively, but it's an option. It's a step. The F is where we get.
Because you wouldn't use the word reinstatement unless there was a need to reinstate.
Right. He's obviously going through the Chapter 21 process where he's proposed for termination. And then.
Would that not presume that, in fact, the termination occurred?
The proposed action, it is finalized in a certain sense at the buyout. Yes, because that's when the statute says, instead of reinstating a teacher under subsection E, the school district may pay the teacher 1 year's salary to which the teacher would have been entitled from the date on which the teacher would have been reinstated. So that's when that's the year of front pay. Okay. What I'm saying is there's a distinction between the proposed termination and the statutory option, because the proposed termination is a decision on the merits about the school board looking and saying, I don't think he's a good employee, I don't think he belongs here, I think there's good reasons to get rid of him. The decision on February 14th is nothing of that kind. It's not you're good, bad, or indifferent. It's, for all intents and purposes, we're tired of this, this is expensive, it's going on for years now, it's been 2 years, this TEA process, and we're going to go through this again? Oh, wait a minute, we have an option? It was unanimous. The decision by Fort Worth Board of Trustees was unanimous on the decision to exercise the statutory option. It was not unanimous on the proposed termination. Those were totally different decisions. Now, you're saying the effect is it ends it, but it's not right to call it an actualized termination versus proposed. Kell takes care of that distinction. It doesn't really matter. And as far as the case law that we were talking about earlier, Powers has not been distinguished at all by counsel opposite. They have not talked about how Powers deals with this. All I can say is, well, Powers is persuasive because it's federal court. But it does directly address someone who initiated through the Chapter 21, who exhausted through the Chapter 21, and who filed their whistleblower lawsuit within the 30 days. And both the Powers District Court and the Powers Federal Court of Appeals, Fifth Circuit, said that's good enough. The person initiated, that was jurisdictional, exhausted, and filed within 30 days of that exhaustion. That's jurisdictional, that's within the time frame, and that was good. So we have the Powers decision that falls right in line with what we're talking about. And as Justice Kerr said, jurisdiction is jurisdiction. It's not a matter that we can be waiving. It's not a matter that we can, because of some misunderstanding of the law that is now clarified for us, we can't be all of a sudden say, well, go back and let's have a do-over. No, that statute was given to us. We didn't create that statute. And a word for a minute about DG Legal that Mr. Wineski wants to emphasize. Those DG Legal policies are essentially attempts to codify what the state law is, but they and put it in a service through TASB provides legal policies. Boards don't vote on legal policies. They only vote on local policies. Those are the true policies of the school district. The legal ones are just a compilation service of what is their understanding of the laws that they're operating under, not the laws that they're creating. So when you see DG Legal, it's an attempt at best to try to describe what the law is that we're operating under. I see my time's up, and I ask the court to reverse and render judgment and dismiss this case for lack of jurisdiction.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we thank you for your argument. It's been very helpful. Your case has been submitted. The court is in recess for a few minutes to get ready for the 10:30.